tomorrow's lecture is going to be about, and I don't know yet, so we'll see. Maybe it'll be more chiral fermions. So where I stopped yesterday, just mentioned the Nielsen-Nanomio theorem. I just said what it states is that if you have a lattice fermion operator D, so some bilinear action with some D in it, but that D cannot satisfy all four of these properties, namely analytic and periodic in P. Periodic because we're on a lattice, so you have on a Brillouin zone. It can't, or it has to go to the, you want it to go to the Dirac form for the continuum limit, namely long wavelength modes. You want it to exist everywhere, the inverse to exist everywhere except for at P equals zero. That's the statement, you only want one mode. And it's chirally invariant, namely gamma 5 anti-commutes. So just some examples of fermions and where they fail. So if you take naive fermions, it satisfies everything. Except for number three, and that's because there's doubling. Namely, there's not only a pole at p equals zero, but also at each of the corners of the Brillouin zone. So you see, this is a nice periodic analytic function. It has the right Dirac structure as you take 8 times p goes to 0. It anti-commutes with gamma 5, but it's got poles. So D inverse, it has zeros at p mu equals 0 or pi over a for each mu. Or it's got 2 to the n, the propagator is 2 to the n poles, 2 to the d, or d to the dimensions. Then the Wilson fermions. So in this case, what you do is you write down psi bar n. Momentum space, you get a gamma mu sine p mu a over a plus m plus minus 2a r. I'm not sure that 2 is supposed to be there. Cos a p mu minus 1. This term is put in to get rid of the doubling. So now you don't have poles at pi over a, because at pi over a, this is equal to minus 2. Cosine minus 1 is minus 2. And so you don't have the zeros of this operator at the corner of the Brillouin zone. But you do have chiral symmetry breaking explicitly, because you have this m. This comes from an m psi bar psi. If I look at the sort of the continuum version of the operators that gave rise to this, M comes from a mass term, and this comes from a R psi bar box psi. So this was put in there to effectively give a mass to the high frequency modes, the ones that are, have wave number on the order of pi over a. So it has no effect on low frequency modes, because box goes to zero for long wavelength, but it kills all the very high frequency modes. But both of these violate chiral symmetry. And you know, you tune these against each other so that you get massless pions in the limit. But the Dirac the Wilson operator itself fails number 4. And it just violates chiral symmetry because, remember, chiral symmetry is independent rotation of left and right modes, but these two operators couple left. There was a brief flurry of excitement about something called the slack derivative. Which you don't have to know much about because it has died a long time ago. It basically was just this. Take the lattice momentum, P, and just write D equals P slash. Well, now you've got a problem, which is that on the Brillouin zone, this is what the operator is. So when you go to the next Brillouin zone, it's like that. So this fails number one. Fails to satisfy number one. Now, why is this bad? There's some literature on killing this thing. I have to confess I've never read it. Okay, but the way I understand it is the following, is look at QED and look at something called the Ward identity. A Ward identity is just a statement that gauge invariance means that if you have an A mu, it comes in a covariant derivative d mu, which is d mu plus minus I e A mu. So that means that if you have a coupling of a gauge boson to a fermion, it's going to come along with the derivative, which affects the fermion dispersion relation. So the Ward identity is a relationship between the photon coupling to the fermion and its dispersion relation. In particular, if you say the propagator is S inverse of P, and this is in the continuum, and so this is the exact propagator, all quantum corrections included, and the exact vertex is IE, let me make this a positively charged particle, IE gamma, capital gamma mu, it's also a function of momentum, then the statement that the A mu comes with the D mu is equivalent to the statement that gamma mu of P is equal to D by D P mu S inverse of P times, yeah. So for example, for a free fermion, S inverse of P is equals P slash plus M, in which case this thing here would be just gamma mu. And so it says that the photon vertex is i.e. gamma mu when the fermion is just a free fermion. But it's more general than that, and it just tells you that the P's go with the A's in this combination. Now what happens if you try to take the derivative with respect to momentum of a propagator that comes that looks like that? Okay, and you find everything's fine until you hit the edge of the Brillouin zone. And photons are going to have to couple infinitely strongly there. So these modes that you were hoping to decouple, these very high frequency modes, can't decouple because that's the photons have this in the continuum limit will have an infinitely strong coupling at that point. So it's a sick theory. So Wilson fermions are easy to understand, and it is incorrect to assume that because the lattice operator violates chiral symmetry, that they can't be used to study QCD and QED and so on, which do have chiral symmetry in the continuum. You just have to tune the theory to the chiral point in the continuum. In particular, if you keep the Wilson term coefficient fixed, little r, say, set to 1, then you have to tune m. So by tuning the theory, I mean tune m. And how do you do it? Well, QCD is a very nice theory in that when you hit the chiral limit, you know you're supposed to get massless pions. And so there's a very straightforward way to tune it, namely you look at the spectrum of the theory you're getting out and you tune it to the point where the pion looks like it's getting massless. So the chiral point, which is not at m equals 0, gives you massless pions in QCD. Now, as a counterexample, suppose you wanted to study n equals 1 super Young Mills. That's a theory with gluons, but instead of having quarks transforming like a Dirac fermion, which is a triplet, you have a Biot fermion, which transforms like an octet. Now, in this theory, there is no chiral symmetry, no continuous chiral symmetry, and therefore no spontaneous breaking of a continuous chiral symmetry, and therefore no Goldson bosons. And so there's nothing in the spectrum, there's no simple thing in the spectrum that you can point to that says you're at the chiral point. So it's much, much harder to use Wilson fermions to study a theory like that. Now, this does not occur at m equals 0 because of interactions. If you think again in a continuum language, I've got this, I put in an insertion of psi bar box psi, this dimension 5 operator. So I'm going to do this in the continuum. So rather than lattice spacing, I'll say you've got some cutoff scale in the theory. And now you dress this with a photon. This will give you a divergent graph, which will cut off at lambda. I'm not going to worry about things like gauge invariance right now, but just heuristically, this will give you something that looks like alpha over 4 pi times lambda times psi bar psi as a counterterm. And so you see that you're going to get a linear divergence of the mass. Remember in the beginning I said that one nice thing about chiral symmetry is you get multiplicative renormalization of the fermion mass, but that argument required that the mass term was the only violation of chiral symmetry in the theory. So here we have a second operator that violates chiral symmetry, and now the mass term can have an additive renormalization, and furthermore it's linearly divergent, which in the lattice, which means you have a 1 over a fine-tuning because a linear divergence in a momentum cutoff corresponds to a 1 over a, 1 over lattice basically. So you have a pretty severe fine-tuning problem if you want to get to the continuum limit of small lattice spacing. But it is still, you can do that by looking at the pion spectrum, but you're not done then. Suppose you now want to study electroweak matrix elements. And as I said before, you typically will have lots of different ones, and they'll have different dimensions. And in the continuum, the operators of different dimensions don't mix with each other because of chiral symmetry, but for Wilson fermions, you don't have the chiral symmetry, and so your mixing matrix will have your anomalous dimension matrix will have mixing between these operators, and furthermore, if it mixes a high dimension operator into a low dimension operator, just like this gets mixed in with a mass term, you'll find 1 over 8 type of fine tunings or linear divergence, and that means that every time you want to study this new operators, you've got more fine tunings to do, and it's difficult. So that's a drawback of using Wilson fermions to study something where chiral symmetry is important. However, one thing that's interesting about this is that when you do go to the chiral limit, you can show, and I think this was by Kirsten Smith, that the original theory broke chiral symmetry maximally, right on the scale of the lattice spacing. You're tuning them against each other to get this chiral limit, but the theory does know about chiral symmetry breaking, and the interesting thing is that the only thing that survives into the continuum limit that knows about the chiral symmetry breaking is the anomaly. Remember, I said that if you wanted to reproduce an anomaly using a lattice, you had to violate chiral symmetry explicitly on the lattice somehow, because Jacobian can't do it for you, because it's a finite dimensional system. So here's an example of the Wilson fermion is an example where you break chiral symmetry, you tune it so that you don't see the chiral symmetry breaking in the continuum, but since it is giving you QCD is the continuum limit, it has the anomalies built into it. And you can show that the anomalies come out right. But there's something sort of weird about this. Suppose as a thought experiment, you take Wilson fermions tuned to the chiral point, continuum limit. And by continuum limit, what I want you to think about is not taking the lattice spacing to zero, set that to one, but tune your couplings so that the far infrared is the long wavelength modes are your continuum field theory. And now take this theory, which has chiral symmetry and everything beautiful in the infrared limit, and imagine doing sort of a block renormalization group where you take, four lattice points and map it into one lattice point on a coarser lattice. So this now turns into a lattice with spacing 2a. And so you can do this. And so the idea is to integrate out. Basically, what you're doing is you're integrating out the modes. Modern way of thinking of the continuum way of thinking about the RG is you integrate out the high modes and just leave with the low modes. On the lattice, you can actually do this, at least theoretically, this block transformation to get to a coarser lattice and a coarser lattice and coarser lattice. And so imagine doing that. Keep doing this. Well, so this is the new lattice spacing, eight times the original lattice spacing. Now you keep doing this, and you still have a lattice theory, and it's exactly the same theory. I just re-expressed the variables on a coarser lattice so that it still has the same infrared limit, which has got chiral symmetry and everything in it. But as I keep doing this, I get a more and more complicated lattice theory because I've integrated out all these high modes, but it's got to look more and more like this continuum theory with the infrared symmetries, in particular chiral symmetry, and yet it's still a lattice theory. So you have some D. It's now very complicated. It's not the Wilson D anymore because of all these transformations you've done. But somehow it's got chiral symmetry encoded into it. So it'd be nice to know what this D is becoming and how is it able to give you a chirally symmetric theory while still being a lattice operator. In particular, we know that the thing we started with obeyed points, you know, conditions 1, 2, and 3, and it was just 4 that was violated. So what's happening to 4 as you keep on taking this transformation? And the answer is that when you've taken this system and you've got this this very coarse lattice now, is that you find that this is still non-zero because it's still a lattice operator, has to obey the Nielsen and Amiya theorem, but it obeys it, it violates the chirality, but it violates it in a very simple way, namely, it goes to this, which is the Ginsberg-Wilson equation. And as I mentioned yesterday, if it obeys this, then you have some heuristic understanding why the anomaly works. I haven't shown why you get the right answer, but what I pointed out to you was that this would only give you something non-trivial for three currents if the three currents were sitting on top of each other. So if you do any sort of measurement of properties of hadrons where you put in sources and sinks across your lattice, you're not going to be putting the sources and sinks on top of each other, and therefore you won't see this violation of chiral symmetry because this is... as I said, if you look at it in terms of propagators, this is a unit operator in space, which means that your propagator looks completely chiral unless you were foolish enough to try to propagate from one point to itself, a very short distance type of effect, which is not going to screw up the spectrum of your theory. It's all hand waving, but I just wanted to give you a feel for why this might. It does screw up chiral symmetry, but not in a bad way. Now, in order for this to be of any use, in order for this chiral symmetry to be good enough, it should have the property that it enforces that mass renormalization is multiplicative. Remember, I told you that was one of the key properties of chiral symmetry. So here is an exercise for you. Suppose I have psi bar d psi is my lattice theory. I don't know what d is. But I do know that D satisfies this equation. Okay? to show that your action has an exact symmetry, which is sort of a funny one. It is that psi goes to e to the I alpha gamma 5 1 plus a over 2 d psi. So it looks sort of like a chiral transformation, but it's got this differential operator in it. While psi bar goes to e goes to psi bar e to the I alpha gamma 5 times 1 minus a over 2 d. And you can, to show that this is a symmetry, you only need to show it's true for infinitesimal alpha. So show if you make this transformation and you expand it to linear order in alpha and you use the Ginsburg-Wilson relation, that in fact you're Lagrangian's invariant. Now the reason why that's interesting is because I have an exact symmetry on the lattice, and this forbids psi bar psi. That if you put this in, this is clearly not a symmetry anymore. And notice, by the way, if you took A to 0 on this, this is just ordinary chiral symmetry. So it'll forbid the mass term in the continuum, too. So this is the magic of this relationship, is that it preserves multiplicative renormalization of the mass even at finite lattices. Well, I wanted to do it this way so we're always talking about a lattice operator. In the continuum, when you integrate out, I guess I don't quite understand. What? Well, I'm just saying that the Wilson fermion, when you block it down, has to give you something which gives you this, I mean, you tuned it, so it's going to give you this chiral continuum theory. But it's still a lattice operator, so it has to obey the Nielsen-Nitomia theorem. So the question is, how does that work? We have an operator which violates chiral symmetry, yet as you block down, it's got to inherit all the properties of the continuum theory. And so how is that possible to violate chiral symmetry and still have things like multiplicative mass renormalization and the anomaly? So I just wanted to say that when you block it down like this, you end up getting something which still obeys Nielsen-Nitomia theorem, but in such a way, in this particular way, and this is enough to give you the anomaly and multiplicative mass renormalization without screwing up anything, like spectrum of particles. So, any questions? You shouldn't have any idea where that equation came from at this point, so don't feel like you somehow missed something. Because what I'm going to do now is show you how to derive that equation, but not through an RG blocking, but through a little bit of a cheat, but not quite. So the idea is, rather than going from the lattice to the continuum, which is hard, I'm going to go from the continuum to a lattice, which is easy. But what I'm going to do is the lattice is for, it's going to be for the fermions. But I'll have continuous gauge fields. So you're not going to see any link variables here. Okay, that's what makes this somewhat easier. So what I'm going to do, is I'm going to start off with some partition function. Where I've got this is in the continuum. And I'll take S of psi and psi bar to equal psi bar A d slash psi a, where a is equal to 1 to nf. So I've got nf flavors of fermions, and it's no mass term. And this theory is invariant up to anomalies. UNF left plus UNF right symmetry. Now I'm going to invent a lattice variable. This psi at a integer lattice point is defined to be an integral d4x f of x minus a n times psi of x. Those are four vectors, where f is localized, some function that's peaked at x equals 0 with support for x less than approximately equal to a. In other words, some function which is peaked on some lattice socket, whatever. So for every little square, I'm averaging my fermion field over that function. And so I'm only really sensitive to the value of the function in that little region. I'm not sensitive. Psi sub n only does not depend on the value of psi far away from the point n. So now I'm going to use fancy way of writing 1 as a path integral of a Gaussian. So I've just introduced an integration variable. Psi n's and psi bar n's are functionals of my original field. But because I'm integrating over these things, I can just shift the chi's by them. They go away. Some Gaussian path integral. Put a normalization there, soak up all the root pi's, and I get 1. And what I'm going to do is stick that into the path integral for z, and then blithely, without assuming there are no mathematicians in the class, invert the order of integration. Integrate out the fermion psi and psi bar, and get write the partition function as an integral over chi and chi bar. You have to remember that psi n and psi n bar are functionals of psi and psi bar. So this is product over all different lattice sets. Okay? And this can be written as e to the minus s lattice of chi n bar, if I knew how to integrate out the fermion psi and psi bar. And because everything is Gaussian, s is bilinear, this thing is bilinear, this is equal to e to the minus chi bar d chi, where I've dropped indices, but chi bar d chi is defined by chi bar n d m d m n. So it's, in other words, it's a lattice action. It's bilinear. Any questions? On what? This is not for mathematicians, so no. It's just localized. What I'm going to show, however, is that because the original Z had this exact chiral symmetry, it follows that this D will have very specific properties. Okay, and I'm never going to use the structure, the form of F. In fact, what I'm going to show you is that this D obeys the Ginsburg-Wilson equation. Okay, so let's change. Let us now take the following transformation. Let's define U is equal to e to the I epsilon gamma 5. T, where this is some UN generator, UNF generator. And consider what happens if I take chi goes to U chi, and chi bar goes to chi bar. Okay, so now what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at this equation here. And I'll say that I get e to the minus chi bar u du chi is equal to integral d psi bar e to the minus alpha. And then it's going to look a little messy here, chi n. U minus psi bar n u chi n minus psi n minus s of psi bar. But I can make this a little less messy if I now do a change of variables where I also put u on the right of psi bar n and a u on the left of psi n. But remember, psi n and psi bar n are just linear related to psi, so the way I do that is I change psi by a u and a u bar. So I'm going to do a change of variables now. Remember, psi and psi bar are dummy variables. They're in the integral. So make that change of variables. Sorry about that. Got a little excited there. Okay, so I do that, but I have to remember that there's an anomaly. The measure is not invariant under that transformation. So first of all, I know that S of psi bar is equal to S of psi prime psi bar prime. This is the classical chiral symmetry. That's the statement that the theory was, well, we knew what S was. This is just psi bar d slash psi, so it's invariant under that symmetry. But d psi bar is equal to d psi prime d psi bar prime times e to the I epsilon integral d4x times the anomaly that Fujikawa told us about times the trace of T. It's only the U1 that's anomalous, not the SUN part of the UNF. And the anomaly is just equal to one over 16 pi squared epsilon A, B, C, D, F, A, B, F, C, D, and the integral d4x times the anomaly is equal to 2 nu, where nu is an integer, equal to the winding number of the gauge field. And I don't have time to go over instantons and stuff like that, but again, I refer you to Sidney Coleman's lectures on uses of instantons if you haven't seen this before. Just accept, if you haven't seen it before, that the measure is not invariant because of a Jacobian. We're in the continuum. Jacobians are infinite matrices. They have to be regulated. Fujikawa did all that for us, told us what to put in there for the Jacobian. It's this thing. So when I do that now, I find then that the right-hand side of this equation here, namely this path integral, can be written as psi prime d psi bar prime e to the I epsilon times 2 nu trace t times e to the minus alpha chi bar n minus psi bar prime n u squared chi n minus psi n prime minus s of psi prime psi bar prime. So the reason for doing this is now the u's are not in a complicated combination where the chi's have them and the psi's don't. Now, the trick is you just expand both sides of the equation to linear order in epsilon. Okay, the left-hand side is equal to minus chi bar anti-commutator of gamma 5 with d times chi e to the minus chi bar d chi. Now remember, we never solved for d. D is some horrible thing. I don't know how to do that math. But all I know is that whatever it is, this is what happens if I expand this to order epsilon. Yes. Sorry? Yeah, absolutely. I dropped it here and I put it back in later. Right. It won't matter whether I put it on one side or the other, because in the end, on this part, I'm going to set it to the unit matrix. So. Okay, so what about the other side, the right-hand side? I'm going to, since psi primes are dummy indices, I'm going to drop the primes now to keep the notation a little bit nicer. And you get integral d psi bar, and then you get 2 nu trace t minus sum on n 2 alpha. Alpha is that parameter I haven't specified yet. Chi bar n minus psi bar n gamma 5 t chi n minus psi n. The 2 comes from fact u squared. Times e to the minus alpha times chi bar n minus psi bar n chi n minus psi n minus s. Now, the trick is, and you bring this as, you bring this out as derivatives, namely, this is equal to 2 nu trace t minus sum on n d by d chi n times I x2 over alpha sum on n d by d chi n gamma 5 t d by d chi bar n acting on integral d psi bar e to the minus alpha bar n minus psi n chi n minus psi n minus s. So the point is that when I take d by d chi bar n, there's a chi bar n, it brings down an alpha minus alpha times this. And that is going to give me that factor. When I take the derivative with respect to chi n, it brings down a factor of alpha times this, which gives me that factor. So I had an alpha squared. In order to get the alpha up here, I have to put a 1 over alpha to start with. And then the sign comes from the fact that these are fermions and the order of differentiation matters. Now, the reason why this is nice is because this is just my, I can't do this path integral, but I know I've got a name for it, which is e to the minus chi bar d chi. And now I've got a factor of e to the minus chi bar d chi on both sides. Get rid of it. So now I don't have any path integrals anymore. I've got an equation that that just involves this acting on that, and that's easy to do, because when I take derivatives of chi or chi bar on this, it just brings down the powers of D, my unknown fermionic operator. When you do that, when you're done, you've got that side equals this side, and you set the following. Make it neat. Take alpha to be 2 over A, the same A, if you want, that appears in F, but it's basically a choice of dimensions. You end up with the following equation that chi bar anticommutator of gamma 5 with d times t minus a d gamma 5 d t chi equals a times trace gamma 5 d t minus 2 nu trace t. Now, I left off a few steps which you can fill in at home. The point is that when you take d by d chi and d by d chi bar of this, there are two things you can get. You can either get them both acting on the same chi bar d chi, which brings down a power of d, which is this d here with no chi's in it, or I can bring down, I can bring down one of these with the first derivative and another one with this other derivative, and that gives something that's bilinear in chi bar chi and bilinear in d. And that gives me this term with a chi and a chi bar on it still. Okay, now this has to be true for any set of fields chi. Remember, these are have lattice subscripts. These are a matrix on the lattice. At any value of chi, these are some variable I just stuck in the first place, it has to be true. And therefore, both of these sides have to independently vanish. Because it's true for any chi. So the left-hand side has to vanish. I'll set t equals the unit matrix. The left-hand side tells me that gamma 5 anticommutator with d equals a d gamma 5 d, which is the Ginsberg-Wilson equation. And the right-hand side, and I'll also set t equals 1, gives me a bonus, which tells me that the trace of gamma 5 d is times a is equal to 2 nu times n flavor. And this thing, this is very interesting because it relates the spectrum of this operator d to a property of the gauge fields. And this is what you call an index theorem. And it's very useful in practice because if you can find a D that obeys the Ginsburg-Wilson equation, then you've got a way of measuring properties of the gauge field by looking at the spectrum of the Dirac operator. Now, what's unfair about this derivation, as I said, is I kept continuum gauge fields, and so there's no issue about what topology means. But when you go on a lattice, it's a little less obvious, okay? But it's still true that if you look at the low line, that you can define the topology of the gauge fields through this equation, say, I'm going to define nu to be equal to this trace. Okay, and the trace is always going to give you an integer. Now, the advantage of this is that in the old days, people were looking for instantons. And if you look at a typical gauge field configuration, it's just incredibly noisy. Okay, you don't see these beautiful topological classical solutions anywhere. Okay, so people would cool them. They'd try to relax them. And the problem is when you do that, the thing, if you do it long enough, it'll just relax away to nothing. So people tried to cool them in a way that made the rough parts go away but kept the topological lumps. And it was very ambiguous whether you were seeing instantons, anti-instantons, or what. But now you have an unambiguous way of, on a rough gauge field, you just look for basically for chiral zero modes of your operator, and that tells you a way of defining where the topology of the gauge field is sitting on the lattice. Yeah. I'm sorry? Oh, you got me there. I don't know. Should that A be there? Let me think. It's got to be there by dimensions, right? Because nu is dimensionless. So A times D is going to go to a constant. But why it's not going to zero? I'll have to. Oh, I think it's because. I'll try to answer the next lecture. Okay. But you're right. By dimensions, it has to be there. It wouldn't make sense to erase it. So the Ginsburg-Wilson paper was published in 1982. And in 1996, it had received 3 citations. 2 in 1984 and 1 in 1985. Okay. It was completely forgotten. Okay. And the question is, why was this marvelous thing forgotten? And the answer is because they didn't provide a solution to this equation. Okay. Remember, this D, we've been manipulating this D, but this D is expressed as this horrible path integral of gauge fields over fermions. It's a nasty-looking thing. How do you evaluate it? So they have this equation. This is what the ideal lattice operator will obey, but there's no solution to it. So nobody paid any attention. So in the 90s, this solution was found. And the first step was related to something that string theorists were doing. So there have always been string theorists. It's just that before string theory, they worked on different things. String theorists in the 70s worked on magnetic monopoles. And string theorists in the early 80s worked on anomalies. And then when they understood everything about anomalies in different dimensions, they suddenly discovered that for certain string theories, all the anomalies canceled and it became string theories. But the anomaly work was very interesting. When people started working out anomalies in different dimensions, they found there were weird relations between them. So in even dimensions, you've got chirality, even space-time dimensions. You can define chirality and you've got the chiral anomaly that I discussed. In odd dimensions, you don't have a gamma 5. You can't define something that anti-commutes with all the gamma matrices. You have something called the parity anomaly. And all of these are topological, and people were trying to figure out what the relation was. And Zimino and Wu, I believe, wrote down a relation that took you from the anomaly in one dimension to an anomaly in another dimension. It was very mathematical and sort of hard to understand what was going on. And so Callan and Harvey came up with a simple picture of how it worked by making a physical model of how a particle in some higher dimension could get stuck to a defect in lower dimension. And in doing so, you could understand how the anomalies of the lower dimension theory was related to the anomalies in the higher dimension theory. So in particular, it was known since the mid-70s that if you couple a fermion to a defect in its mass that looks like a domain wall, you find that you get a massless mode stuck to it. And furthermore, it can be a chiral mode, namely just left-handed, just right-handed. So let's talk about the continuum first, and let's talk about three dimensions, Euclidean. And so Dirac spinners are two-dimensional, are two-component, because you can write down your gamma matrices as gamma 1 equals sigma 1, gamma 2 equals sigma 2, gamma 3 equals sigma 3. But notice, so I need all three gamma matrices if I'm going to live in three dimensions. But notice there's no room for defining a gamma 5 which anticommutes with them all. Can't solve this equation. Can't find a 2x2 matrix that anticommutes with all three power vectors. Okay? So there's no chirality. No chirality, no anomaly, at least not the anomaly that we've been discussing. So let's just look at a Dirac fermion. Here's the Dirac equation. What you're interested in, if you want to write down your path integral in terms of modes, you'll typically want to solve for some eigenvalue equation. I want to do this. I want to solve an equation like that, and then you can expand your modes, your fermions and modes of that operator. And the thing that's interesting is if you take M is a function of X3, which has the following form, namely it goes from, say, plus M naught on one side and minus M naught on the other, you can solve D3 gamma 3 minus M of X3. This equation has a, what we call a zero mode, a solution eigenfunction of that operator with zero eigenvalue. In particular, if I use that basis, this operator is D3 plus M of X3 and minus D3 plus M of X3. And so you can immediately see there are two solutions. So I'm going to look for one which is at, which has no wave, no momentum in the x1 and x2 direction, which is constant. And so you find that there is two solutions, psi plus equals 1, 0, e to the minus integral x3 M of S ds, and psi minus equals 0, 1, e to the plus x3 M of S ds. This one looks like this, and this one looks like that, and that's no good. Not normalizable. You throw this mode out. This is not an acceptable mode in your mode expansion for the path integral. So you keep this one, and it is stuck to this defect with an exponentially small width. And so the low energy theory is going to just involve this fermion, and it's only allowed to ride along this defect, which is a one plus one or two-dimensional theory. Plus one in Minkowski space. So it's on a wire, okay? And it's in 1 plus 1, you can take gamma 1 equals sigma 1 and gamma 2 equals sigma 2. But in 1 plus 1 dimension, we've seen there is a notion of chirality because I can find another gamma matrix which anticommutes to this, which I'll call gamma 5, just for tradition. And of course, it's just sigma 3. It's the thing that anticommutes with the matrix. And this is an eigenstate of sigma 3 with sigma 3 equals plus 1. So this is a right-handed fermion in a one-plus-one dimensional world. Now, that's a little weird because the original theory had no anomalies. There's no chiral symmetry. But now if I turn on an E field that points in the X direction along this defect, according to our analysis, we've got a single chiral mode now, which means, or rather, what this the spectrum of this theory looks like is that there's no right-handed mode. There are massive modes, because I didn't look at all the other eigenmodes here, but they're things with mass in the order of m-naught. I guess these are empty. And now I turn on an E field, and these things march up, and lo and behold, charge is violated. Now, before, when I had a rack fermion, I got some marching up, some marching down, charge wasn't violated. But here, it looks like this theory is anomalous. This is very weird. Where is this charge coming from? Because in the original 3D theory, charges, there's no anomaly. Charge can't be violated. So what Callan and Harvey showed was that what goes on here is if I want to get to this effective theory, I have to integrate out all the heavy modes. So let's pretend that the mass is constant here, and let me integrate out the heavy modes, and then I have to add up all of the graphs with external photons, and that'll give me some effective operators in the low-dimension effective theory. In particular, there is one interesting contribution from this diagram here. So I'm integrating out the heavy modes, and this gives me a contribution to my effective action, which is called the Chern-Simons operator. Which is proportional to epsilon ABC AA DB AC. But the thing that's really interesting about the proportionality is that it's got a fixed number out in front, which it's in my notes somewhere, but I don't see it right now. So there's some number which involves the electric coupling, obviously. But the thing is that its dependence on the mass of the fermion is this. Notice this is a dimension 3 object by the usual counting, and this is an operator in a three-dimensional theory, so it would be a marginal interaction, so its coefficient has to be dimensionless. And that's weird, because you expect when you integrate a heavy field, the effect should decouple. It should be like the Fermi interaction. When you integrate out the W, you get something that goes away as the W mass becomes large. This is just proportional to the sine. And therefore, you get a plus 1 when you integrate out the fermions on one side, and you get a minus 1 when you integrate out the fermions on the other side. So no matter what the actual shape of the domain wall, you get that for its coefficient, except for I'm cheating a bit because I pretended I could integrate out with a constant mass, which is true far away. The actual behavior near here is not being computed here. But the important thing is that it changes sine of two sides. Now, when I look at Maxwell's equations, the current is defined to be the variation with respect to a mu, and this thing gives me a piece that looks like, well, I've got the zero mode contribution, the effective theory, but I now also have a contribution from this operator that I got from integrating out the heavy fermions. This looks like epsilon mu AB DA AB. And so notice that this gives me a contribution. I set mu equals 3. That's the direction perpendicular to the domain wall, it's got a contribution to the current that looks like it's proportional to the two-dimensional electric field, and it's got opposite signs on the two sides of the wall. So what I get is that, remember, when I turned on an electric field here, I found, oh my god, charge is being violated on the domain wall. It keeps building up and building up. But there's now a new contribution to the current, which is flowing like this. And so from the 3D point of view, there's no violation of charge. This is flowing in from the two sides out of the vacuum, out of the heavy modes, rearranging themselves, and then flowing onto the wall. So here's a theory where the 3D theory had no chirality, yet the low energy theory has a massless fermion, which has a chiral symmetry. The full theory has no anomaly, but the effective theory does. What I'll talk about next time is if you put a wall anti-wall pair so that the mass looks like this, now you've got a left-handed fermion on one side, a right-handed fermion on the other side. And when you turn on electric fields, charge can get exchanged between the two of them, but because their wave functions are so localized, they can't overlap much, and therefore you can't give them a mass. They have to couple one to the other in order to give a mass term. So this is a theory where the mass is protected from being generated by radiative corrections, and it has the right anomaly structure. And it's formulated in a theory where there was no discussion about chirality, so you might think you can latticize it now with Wolfson fermions, because you don't have to worry about chirality, and you'll automatically get chiral modes as the low energy limit of it. So what I'll do next time is I'll talk to you about domain wall fermions, and then there's overlap fermions, which take the domain wall and ask, what is the 4D effective theory? Let's formulate it completely in a 4D language. And then that's a very beautiful way of looking at it, and you can show that it's an explicit and rather simple to write down solution to the Ginsburg-Wilson equation. Thanks. Questions? Hang up by the coffee.